Hello and welcome to today's South Pacific Weather Training Teleclass. My name is Jane Barnett and I'm speaking to you from Christchurch, New Zealand. And I'd like to welcome our speaker today, is Dr. Stephen McBride, who is being broadcast from Auckland in New Zealand. Stephen's currently working as an infectious disease registrar at Auckland City Hospital, and his interest in infectious diseases was, I'm told, sparked by a three-month elective in the Solomon Islands during his medical school training. His special interest is in nosocomial and device-related infections, which led to a project piloting a scheme to reduce unnecessary IV device dwell time. And this was presented at the 2007 Australasian Society of Infectious Diseases New Zealand branch. It's a bit of a mouthful, but was subsequently published. His subject for today's teleclass is therefore very appropriately peripheral IV line sepsis. So welcome, Siva. Thank you very much for agreeing to be part of this Weber Training Telecast program.
Well, thank you, Jane, and thank you, Paul, for the invitation to speak today. I think Jane's covered all that needs to be said about me by way of introduction, and I hope you've got the slides in front of you, everyone, and hopefully we'll all flow smoothly through the presentation, which I've entitled Prevention of Peripheral Intravascular Device-Related Infections. So we'll move on from the title slide. And I'll just give a little bit of a background, which I'm sure is familiar to everyone listening, but I think is important to state in a discussion like this. Devices allowing direct access to the vascular compartment have revolutionized modern medical practice, and without these devices, many of our diagnostic and therapeutic practices would be impossible. Intravascular device use is widespread in our hospitalized patients, and the type of device that's used and the sort of cross-section of devices amongst patients is different in various different areas. But in my area, which has largely been in adult medicine, we tend to use mostly peripheral intravenous catheters, and that stimulated my interest in this particular topic, really. Infections associated with these devices are known to carry a significant associated morbidity, mortality, and cost, which is very clear from the medical literature. Moving on to the next slide. Outline of today's talk, I'll discuss the types of peripheral intravascular devices used, the infectious complications of these peripheral intravascular devices, the relative importance of peripheral intravascular device-related importance. We'll briefly review the CDC guidelines on intravascular catheter infection prevention and discuss locally appropriate quality assurance strategies. Moving on to the next slide. There are a few abbreviations that I've just listed on the screen there, which I'll be using through this talk. IVD being intravascular device. I've used the abbreviation PIVC for peripheral intravascular catheter, PICC for or PIC line for peripherally inserted central catheter, CVC for central venous catheter, and BSI for bloodstream infection. Moving on to the next slide, peripheral intravascular catheters types in common use. The first type, which you can see pictures of on the screen in front of you if everything's going well, is the short plastic peripheral intravascular catheter. Moving on to the next slide. Another type of peripherally inserted, although centrally terminating, intravascular catheter is the PIC line or peripherally inserted central catheter, which you can see pictures of on the screen in front of you, hopefully. Moving on to the next slide. So what are the infectious complications of peripheral intravascular catheters that we're interested in preventing? The first is phlebitis. Phlebitis is obviously a common condition, and various reports have noted up to 26% of peripheral intravascular catheters are associated with phlebitis, although this clearly depends on your definition of phlebitis, and some of the broader definitions have included just symptoms of pain, for example, which are obviously able to be present without actual inflammation of the vein in which the device is sitting. Suppurative or infective phlebitis affects between 0.2 and 2% of all peripheral intravascular catheters, as reported by Tagelakis et al. The references, incidentally, for this talk are on the last slide. The literature on morbidity, mortality and cost of phlebitis is actually minimal, and I think that that's an opportunity for further research. However, it's easy to see how phlebitis gets lost in the shuffle compared to the much more serious infections, which we'll come on to talk to on the next slide, which we'll move to now. Bloodstream infection is an uncommon but frequently severe complication of peripheral intravascular catheters. The literature demonstrates a substantial morbidity, mortality and cost of intravascular device-related bloodstream infections, and depending on the period of review, that cost has been estimated between about $30,000 and $56,000, which is a major cost. Much of the literature does focus on central venous catheter-associated bloodstream infections, and there is significantly less information in the literature on peripheral intravascular catheter-associated bloodstream infections. But this probably actually relates to the rates of infection per device rather than to device prevalence, as I'll discuss later in the talk. Moving on to the next slide, metastatic infections are obviously potentially the result of hematogenous spread of infection from the site of a peripheral intravascular catheter which has become infected, and include endocarditis, osteoarticular infections, and infections at other sites. Moving on to the next slide, what are the bloodstream infection rates for these different types of devices? Dennis Mackey and other authors published in Mayo Clinic Proceedings 2006 an excellent meta-analysis, including prospective English language reports from medical literature from 1966 to 2005, which reported pooled bloodstream infection rates from the various studies for different vascular devices. Moving on to the next slide, this table presents in summary form the pooled rates of bloodstream infections per 1,000 catheter days for various types of peripheral intravascular catheters. As you can see, plastic short peripheral intravascular catheters, the standard lures that we see on the medical wards, have an associated rate of 0.5 bloodstream infections per 1,000 catheter days, whereas PICC lines in patients have a rate of a pooled mean of 2.1 bloodstream infections per 1,000 catheter days. It's worth noting that when these PICC lines are used in outpatient settings, the rate is significantly lower. And for the sake of comparison, I've presented the data on the bloodstream infections per 1,000 catheter days for different types of central venous catheters, and as you can see, non-cuffed, non-tunneled, non-medicated central venous catheters have a significantly higher rate again of bloodstream infections of 2.7 bloodstream infections per 1,000 catheter days, and chlorhexidine, sulfasulfadiazine coating, minocycline, rifampicin, impregnation substantially reduce these rates. Moving on to the next slide. So how important are peripheral intravascular catheter-related infections? Well, I would argue that the relative importance depends on the usage in your situation. As I've mentioned, the literature emphasizes central venous catheter-related infection, but the rates per 1,000 catheter days are significantly higher than for peripheral intravenous catheters. In a study we performed in 2006, and I'm presenting unpublished data here, on adult medical wards, almost 99% of catheter days were with peripherally inserted devices, and only 1.2% were with central venous catheters. Using Mackey et al.'s pooled mean bloodstream infection rates for our particular situation on the adult medical wards at Auckland City Hospital, peripheral intravascular catheter-associated bloodstream infection would be expected to be more than 45 times as common as central venous catheter-associated bloodstream infections due to the device mix. Using data from the same study, 54.4% of patient days on internal medicine wards at Auckland City Hospital were associated with an intravascular device day. Our institution has about 900 beds, depending on occupancy and staffing. If all areas had significant and similar rates of intravascular device prevalence, which is a bit of a leap of logic, but may well be true overall, then that equates to about 500 intravascular device days for each hospital day, and we should expect to have approximately one intravascular device-related bloodstream infection every 4 days. If 50% of these infections were preventable, which they probably are, as I will discuss later on, we could potentially prevent 45 intravascular device-related bloodstream infections per year at an estimated conservative cost savings of over $1 million a year for our institution, and those are US dollars rather than New Zealand dollars. Moving on to the next slide. So how do we prevent infection? Well, many of these IVD-associated infections are preventable. Multiple studies have shown various interventions to result in significant reductions in IVD-related infections, and particularly in bloodstream infections, which are an easily measured, often surveyed measure of complications from intravascular devices. Moving on to the next slide. The CDC has published excellent guidelines through the years on the prevention of intravascular device-related infections, and the most recent set of guidelines were published in 2002 by O'Grady et al. In Mortality and Morbidity Weekly Report, with the reference you can see there or see at the end of this PowerPoint presentation. And these suggest a number of evidence-based strategies to prevent IVD-related infections. The degree of evidence base of these recommendations does vary, and the guidelines do discuss the veracity of the evidence that they're based on, and I think that there are some of the recommendations from the guidelines which you can argue about, but overall they are very useful and do present an excellent summary of the evidence up to the date of their publication. Moving on to the next slide. So the CDC guidelines firstly emphasise quality assurance. They emphasise that ongoing quality assurance programs are vital. They emphasise the use of standardised adequate aseptic techniques for intravascular device insertion and maintenance, and also that these devices should be inserted and maintained by staff who are experienced in the insertion and maintenance of intravascular devices. The evidence strongly suggests that adequate staffing levels in the institution are very important as IVD-related complications increase with decreasing staffing adequacy. And further, in terms of quality assurance, the CDC guidelines suggest specialist IV teams for monitoring intravascular devices, and I'll discuss this strategy further later on in the presentation. Moving on to the next slide. The CDC guidelines have a number of discussions on insertion site of peripheral intravascular devices. There are lower infection rates in upper limb versus lower limb sites and in hand veins versus wrist or antecubital fossa veins. Catheter material is also potentially important, and Teflon or polyurethane has performed better in terms of lower infection rates than polyvinyl chloride or polyethylene devices. Moving on to the next slide. Hand hygiene is obviously important. The guidelines recommend washing with either waterless alcohol-based solution or antibacterial soap. Obviously, not touching the puncture site after cleaning is important, and the guidelines emphasise that gloves are required as part of universal precautions. However, they are not required for infection control purposes in terms of the devices, because you're not supposed to be touching the area after antisepsis has been performed. Moving on to the next slide. the guidelines emphasise that skin antisepsis should be performed prior to puncture, and note that in studies of central venous catheters, chlorhexidine has been found to be superior in terms of infective complications to alcohol or iodine. However, there hasn't been a reproduction of this sort of study with peripheral catheters that I'm aware of. The guidelines recommend catheter replacement at between 72 and 96 hours after insertion, but they acknowledge that there is relatively little difference in the infection rates at 96 hours. My personal reading of the literature on this subject is that there seems to be a relatively constant rate of infection per device day overall, rather than relating to the particular timing of a single device in terms of dwell time. So I think we've all looked after people who've got very difficult access, and while protocolized removal of peripheral intravascular devices brings infection control to the front of the minds of the house staff and in some patients with very difficult access, I think it may actually have the potential to cause harm to that particular patient. So it's a balancing act. Moving on to the next slide. The CDC, on the basis of this review of the evidence, makes a number of recommendations. Firstly, they recommend education of all healthcare workers involved in IVD insertion or maintenance or caring for patients with IVDs. They recommend encouraging patients to report IVD-related symptoms. They recommend daily inspection of or palpation of the IVD site in every patient. And they emphasise the ever-important need for hand hygiene. As we've discussed, aseptic technique for insertion and for use of IVDs is vitally important, and they recommend a sterile, transparent or absorbent dressing to be placed over the insertion site. Moving on to the next slide. The guidelines recommend against using antimicrobial ointments on insertion sites, as this has not been found to be effective in preventing infections. They recommend against prolonged submerging of the catheter underwater, although noting that brief submerging in water, such as occurs in showering, is probably okay. And they recommend changing the overlying dressing if the dressing is wet or dirty or loose. Obviously, we should be aiming for the lowest infection risk in terms of the choice of site for the catheter and the catheter type and the insertion technique. And logically, but relatively far down the list of priorities, they recommend prompt removal of unnecessary intravascular devices. Moving on to the next slide. The recommendation is made that peripheral intravascular catheters are replaced every 72 to 96 hours, although I personally have some caveats, as I've already said, on that. They recommend removing intravascular devices if there are any signs of phlebitis, signs of infection, or if the device is malfunctioning. The guidelines recommend the use of a PICC line if intravenous therapy will exceed a duration of 6 days. I think this is a reasonable recommendation from a practical standpoint because of the difficulty of replacing multiple peripheral intravenous catheters. However, I think that with the higher infection rate, which is associated with PICC lines as compared to peripheral intravenous lines, I'm not sure quite how an exact duration of 6 days was chosen. The guidelines recommend the use of upper limb sites in preference to lower limbs, and recommend replacement of devices which are placed at higher risk sites for infection, that these are replaced by lower risk site for infection devices as soon as possible. Moving on to the next slide. We already talked about the recommendations for quality assurance programs to be ongoing in our institutions from the CDC guidelines, and I wanted to talk through what I feel is an important issue of making sure that these quality assurance programs are locally appropriate. Multiple different approaches to quality assurance in the prevention of peripheral intravascular catheter-related infections have been found to be effective in the literature. Approaches to prevention need to be tailored to the local situation and in particular to the local resourcing. And any quality assurance program requires adequate surveillance in order to ensure the effectiveness of the program. Moving on to the next slide. So what I'm going to do now is just discuss a few of the approaches for which there's some published evidence, starting with the IV team approach. And I'm just going to pick one paper to discuss each approach and talk about the pros and cons of these approaches. So Swaffer et al. Published in Archives of Internal Medicine in 1998 a randomized control trial of management of intravascular devices by a dedicated IV team of predominantly nursing staff versus the standard management of IV devices by the house surgeons and nursing staff on the wards. And the IV team approach, in which every patient was reviewed daily and every device was reviewed and inspected and removed if there were suspicions of problems or problems obvious by the IV team, showed a significantly lower rate of inflammation at the IV site in the IV team patients, and a significantly lower bloodstream infection rate. There's a relatively low number, as you can see, three bloodstream infections, and those looked after by the house staff versus none, and those looked after by the IV team. However, this is highly statistically significant. Of note, the patients looked after by the IV team required significantly more in the way of catheter numbers. They had more devices. However, this is likely to be as a result of the early removal of any devices which had any suspicion underlying whether they were infected or not, and seems appropriate given the results. Moving on to the next slide. So the pros of the IV team strategy: this is an evidence-based strategy which has shown benefit in reducing bloodstream infections as well as phlebitis. The cons are that this is a resource-intensive system of quality assurance, and it is cost-intensive in terms of requiring dedicated staff to see every patient in the hospital every day and look at every catheter. In highly resourced settings, this is very likely to be cost-effective, given that it is effective in reducing bloodstream infections and given the high cost of bloodstream infections to the healthcare system. But in other situations where there are fewer resources, this may not be cost-effective. Moving on to the next slide. The staff education approach. There are multiple publications which have shown that educational programs reduce IVD-related infections by half to two-thirds. And I chose an example close to home, being in Australia while I'm in New Zealand. Collignol et al. In the Medical Journal of Australia in 2007 reported the results of an eight-year education program focusing on staff education around the prevention of intravascular device-related infections. And the rate of IVD-related or IVD-associated bloodstream infection fell in their institution from 0.6 bloodstream infections per 1,000 patient days to 0.3 per 1,000 patient days. So it effectively halved over this eight-year period. And they've also reported it in terms of per 1,000 discharges. Now, obviously, the results of observational research like this are going to be interfered with by other changes, including the introduction over that period of, for example, antimicrobial coated or impregnated central lines, which would act to reduce the bloodstream infection rate. However, I think that there are a number of publications with similar results over differing periods in the medical literature and would suggest that staff education is effective. So the pros and cons of this approach, it is evidence-based and effective. It is lower cost potentially than a dedicated staffing for an IV team. The cons are it requires ongoing education of all staff, which requires a lot of time of the existing staff potentially, and also with turnover and throughput of staff and I guess potentially students who are involved in the care of intravascular devices. This needs to be an ongoing education program which is repeated on a regular basis, and also potentially there is the issue of the efficacy of the program decreasing due to staff fatigue from the repeated education that they're receiving about not only this but also everything else that people think is worthwhile educating them about. Moving on to the next slide. The patient education and staff reminders approach. This is an approach that we've recently published about, and so myself and some colleagues, Drs. David Partridge, David Scott and Simon Briggs, became very frustrated at peripheral intravenous catheters being left in situ unnecessarily while we were working as registrars on the medical ward. And we developed, therefore, two low-cost interventions which were suited to our local conditions. This was really a guerrilla intervention. We used existing stationary and existing staff, and so this was a low-cost and locally appropriate. So we developed an educational pamphlet for our patients and reminder stickers for the nursing and medical staff, which were put in the medical chart every day by our clerical staff on the ward, who actually got very into this project, feeling that it was a way that they could actually directly help patients. This was low cost, as I've said, it utilised existing materials and staff. And we developed a set of criteria for the necessity of intravascular devices and then assess the number of intravascular devices and the number of unnecessary intravascular devices daily over a period of 14 days prior to the interventions being carried out and during the pilot introduction of the interventions. We didn't have the resources to track a hard endpoint like bloodstream infections, so we didn't even try to do that. On to the next slide. This is a summary of our results, and you can see from the lowest line on the table that we succeeded in reducing from 20.4% of all patients having an unnecessary intravascular device to 12.6% of patients having an unnecessary intravascular device. This was a 38% reduction overall. Moving on to the next slide. So the pros and cons of the approach that we took. It is a simple and low cost set of interventions. It's effective in reducing unnecessary intravascular device days. And the cons are it may be less effective than other strategies that have been discussed, but I think it is probably complementary to those strategies. Staff adherence to the interventions is very likely to fatigue over time, and data on hard outcomes such as bloodstream infection is lacking. However, I'm pleased to report that Auckland City Hospital is rolling out this strategy this year among a number of our wards, including the Older People's Health, General Medicine and Orthopaedics wards. Moving on to the next slide. Surveillance, as I've mentioned, this is vitally important. It gives us outcome measures by which we can ascertain the success or otherwise of our quality assurance programs. I feel that surveillance is a vital part of infection control. Bloodstream infections are viewed by many and are included in the Australasian guidelines as critical quality control indicators. And results of surveillance should inform ongoing quality assurance processes and be fed back to practitioners who are inserting and or caring for or using intravascular devices. So in summary, what I've tried to present today is that intravascular device-related infections are preventable, that the relative importance of peripheral intravascular device-related infections versus central venous device-related infections depends on their relative utilization within your particular setting, that there are useful guidelines published by the CDC for the prevention of intravascular device-related infections, and that locally appropriate quality assurance programs and infection surveillance are of paramount importance in preventing intravascular device-related infection. And moving on to the next slide, just presented a number of references that I've used in the preparation of this talk, and I'd like to thank Paul and Jane for inviting me to speak once again.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Stephen. That's great. And I have to say, I think this is a really important area for those of us practicing in infection control, because I think for those of us that have been around a number of years, there has been almost an element of complacency setting in around these devices, that oh, it's just another IV device. And I think putting in some of these measures that you've talked about would really help overcome some of those risks for patients. Just a quick question for me before I open up the lines for others who are listening in. Should we really be looking at using device days then instead of bed days, which is currently the Ministry of Health denominator approach here in New Zealand?
I think that both approaches are useful. I mean, the data in terms of infective complications is certainly strongest in terms of device days, but they are by their very nature much more difficult to measure. Our institutions are required to keep a record of bed days, whereas they're not necessarily required to keep a record of device days. So it's having run around the medical wards looking at everyone's catheters, I can testify to the fact that is data which requires a significant amount of extra effort over and above the data that's already collected. So I think that bed days is useful and is still a valid way of looking at things, but device days, I guess, is the gold standard.
And what are your thoughts on the honing in on Staph aureus as a key organism for measurement in bacteremias as opposed to other gram-negative infections?
We certainly see a lot of Staph aureus device-related infections, and I think that it's a reasonable thing to hone in on it. But I think that broader surveillance is an important thing in terms of gram-negative infections. I'm just thinking of a number of cases that I've seen where things that are an emerging problem in our hospitals, such as extended spectrum beta-lactamase producing gram negatives, have caused device-related infections. And I think that just focusing on Staph aureus to the exclusion of other organisms is possibly missing the boat on some emerging problems.
Hello, Stephen. This is Jasmine. Thanks for that. I found that really helpful. What I wanted to ask you is that does the size of the cannula, peripheral cannula, make any difference to the infection rate?
You're referring to the gauge?
Yes.
Yeah. Not that I'm aware of in terms of the evidence that I've seen, but I don't know that I've looked at anything that specifically discussed that. I would imagine, depending on how you define phlebitis, that the, quote, phlebitis rate would be higher with larger gauge cannulae because they're more likely to cause you pain. But I don't know that there's any change in the infection rate with the device size. Perhaps any effect of having a larger breach in the skin might be offset by the fact that they're more painful and therefore patients are more likely to agitate to get them out.
Hello, this is Denise speaking. I'm wondering if you could share some of your criteria perhaps for continuing to leave IVs in patients in your unit?
Yeah, absolutely. The criteria that we developed are by their nature somewhat arbitrary, and we didn't act to remove those catheters that we felt were unnecessary while we were gathering data, although clearly I was very keen to pull them out. Our criteria included what we judged as necessary intravenous antibiotic therapy, being that a patient had been being treated with intravenous therapy for a presumed infection or proven infection for less than 48 hours or for more than 48 hours but had been febrile within the preceding 24 hours, was being treated for an infection where there was no oral alternative antibiotic available, or for a condition such as osteomyelitis where a prolonged course of intravenous therapy was indicated as part of the therapy of the condition. We judged that patients who were on cardiac monitoring or who had had a clinical evidence or endoscopic evidence of a gastrointestinal bleed within 48 hours or a epileptic seizure within 48 hours were allowed to have a catheter in situ. People who were receiving intravenous fluids as required, intravenous medications such as intravenous pain relief with morphine within the preceding 24 hours, or regular intravenous medications such as intravenous diuretics were counted as being necessary intravascular or necessary indications for an intravenous line to be present. I'm just trying to think of the other indications. Any procedure requiring intravenous access planned within the next 24 hours, such as a CT or MRI or an operation. I think that covers the indications that we used. And we did, while we didn't change them while we performed the study, we did sort of evaluate them as we went along. The other thing I should say regarding those indications is we often came across patients with multiple devices, and we thought that you had to have a separate indication for each device that was left in situ. The reference to the paper, which was published in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology, is included in the PowerPoint presentation.
Thank you.
I think those are in there.
Thank you once again, Stephen, for that very relevant contribution to this year's teleclass series. I think it's a really clinically important session, so thank you for that. I think many of us will listen to the recording again at a later date as well. For those of you still with us, you will see on your final slide the remaining teleclass sessions, certainly for the next few months. And within that list, you'll see in August, the South Pacific teleconference session is going to be on the 14th and broadcast live from our National Infection Control Conference in Hamilton. So it would be great to have you listen into that session if you can, and of course any of the others that Paul puts onto his website. So our last broadcast for 2008 later in the year then will be in October by our local expert, David Hammer. So you're all welcome to join us for those. Thank you very much for joining us today. And until the next time, thanks very much. Goodbye.